This is The Guardian.
The big political news of the week should gladden the hearts of everyone who voted Labour 2 months ago. The Prime Minister's been hanging around with far-right Italian politicians in a 17th century villa in Rome, while he's also been spending donors' money on expensive dresses for his wife and new glasses, and getting free Taylor Swift tickets as he tells the rest of us to tighten our belts.
But let's boil it down. Why shouldn't the Prime Minister, he earns 166 grand a year, why shouldn't he buy his own glasses?
Why don't you ask him?
I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Week in the UK for The Guardian. Joining me today is Alita Adu, The Guardian's political correspondent. Hi, Alita.
Hi, John.
We're going to talk about Keir Starmer's trip to Rome and all the politics swirling around it in a moment. But the other big story this week for Labour is Starmer's failure to disclose a £5,000 donation of clothes for his wife Victoria from Labour donor Lord Waheed Ali. There's a bigger story there as well. The Guardian has calculated that Starmer has now declared around £100,000 worth of free tickets, including those for Arsenal games, a Taylor Swift concert and Coldplay as well, and gifts, including clothing and glasses, and that £100,000-ish sum is more than any other major political leader in recent times. This isn't a frivolous, ephemeral story at all, it seems to me, because, as we both know, symbolism in politics is really important. He's telling us all it's going to get worse before it gets better. So lording it around in free clothes and going to concerts with tickets that cost thousands of pounds isn't necessarily a good look. But also, Starmer and his people carpeted Boris Johnson for comparable things, maybe worse things. But nonetheless, they tried to claim the moral high ground. Do you think this is politically dangerous?
I think we are in very dangerous territory, to be honest. Because, I mean, look, just a few weeks ago, the government was really trying its best to justify why they scrapped this winter fuel payment for many pensioners. They've listed their arguments repeatedly over the last few weeks. And, you know, ministers have been sent on rounds justifying that, you know, it's all going to be okay. We're just trying to make the tough decisions now. It's not a good look because, I mean, firstly, it's not Keir Starmer who is being gifted this clothing. It's his wife. I mean, many people would see this as, I mean, does she really need this stuff? Does she really need it? I mean, how many people are going without food? How many people are worrying about their bills going into the wintertime right now? I think the bigger issue is how Keir Starmer himself is handling these accusations. I mean, when we went to Rome with him on Monday, a group of us journalists, we simply asked him, it seems as though you really do believe that you haven't done anything wrong and there's nothing wrong with you declaring around hundreds of thousands of pounds. He seemed quite relaxed and he was like, look, I'll use the example of my love for Arsenal and football. And he said, if I don't accept a gift or hospitality, I can't go to the game because of security reasons. I can't stand with, you know, the crowd and watch the match. So what am I supposed to do? Essentially, he's saying, just not watch the game. And he's kind of like, well, of course I'm going to go and of course I'm going to accept.
You and I both know that there were pictures of Rishi Sunak at a football match. And he wasn't in the sort of flash executive box. I think he was just in the stand. And this isn't the 1970s where we're suggesting that Keir Starmer sits among the hooligans, you know. Surely to God, he can sit in the relatively posh seats in a football ground without having to go to these extremes.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, if we're talking about having to make really difficult decisions, as many of the public are having to make every single day of their lives, one could even argue, why can't he go to his favourite pub and watch the match, or even stay at home and watch the football match? I mean, it's not ideal. It's not ideal.
That would be a tough decision, as he would say. Some people, it seems, believe that Simon Case, the very senior civil servant who I think is on his way out, leaked the story to the press. Have you picked any of that up?
Yes. So my colleague Jessica Elgott has done some reporting on this earlier this week, and basically, a number of people within Number 10 are really hoping that his departure date, which is looking at around January, can be brought forward because they believe he is behind a lot of these briefings and leaks that are going out into the press, you know, especially around Victoria Starmer's gifts that she's accepted.
Frockgate, I think, is the other term that's being bandied around.
He is, you know, somebody who was around during the last couple of years of the Conservative government's. One could argue he wasn't necessarily happy about Sue Gray joining Number 10 when she did, especially after her involvement in Boris Johnson's downfall, which is, of course, ultimately Boris Johnson's own fault around Partygate. But there are just a lot of nervous people who feel as though he's not truly on board with the Labour government. He's not truly on their side. And it's leading to even more tension than there has been already between the likes of Sue Gray and Morgan McSweeney, for example. It's so early on. Labour came into power, July the 5th. It's now, mid-September, and we're really seeing constant briefings every single week. You know, it's not sustainable.
No. I mean, an iron rule of politics, I guess, is if you're worried about people briefing, don't give them things to brief about. That's what springs to mind here. Anyway, let's talk about your trip to Italy. On Monday this week, Keir Starmer visited Rome, where he held a joint press conference at the 17th century Villa Doria Pamphili. Again, sounds quite a grand, opulent setting. With the Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, he praised her government's so-called progress on so-called irregular migration. As we all know, Meloni is a key voice in hard-right European politics with a very unsettling political background that has clear historic links to fascism. Her party's hardline policies, particularly on immigration, highlight all that. So it's perhaps surprising that Starmer has chosen to side himself so closely with her and spend so much time looking at a controversial scheme to process Italian migrants in Albania, among other measures. So there you were on this junket. Just give us a sense of what it was like. Didn't last very long, I don't suppose.
They really did seem to get on. I mean, clearly not as well as Giorgia Meloni got on with Rishi Sunak, because, I mean, we know that Giorgia Meloni used to smoke cigarettes and drink Aperol spritzes in his company. And Keir Starmer told us on the way back from Rome that they didn't drink Aperol spritzes, so that wasn't on the menu.
And no fag.
No. They did have a longish working lunch, and on the day it was Giorgia Meloni's daughter's birthday, and Keir Starmer gifted her some Larry the Cat branded biscuits, which was very nice and apparently well received. But it's not the first time they've met, and you could see that in their body language, especially once the press conference was finished. They sort of didn't want to leave the stage and were quite desperate to get some pictures together and rub shoulders. There was a nice vibe between them, one would argue.
We should just hear a bit of that press conference that you mentioned a moment ago. Here's what Keir Starmer had to say, or some of it.
I am here today for a very simple reason, because I recognise Italy's significance as a leader in Europe, on the world stage, as a G7 economy, a NATO ally. And so as we open what I think will be a new era in Britain's relations with the EU, our close friendship and partnership with Italy is more important than ever. And that's why it was very important for me to come so early on in my term as Prime Minister, as a real statement of intent.
Alita, can you just remind us, in terms of its key features, what current Italian policy is on irregular migration and people seeking asylum, chiefly by crossing the Mediterranean or trying to? So what is it that Keir Starmer seems to admire?
I'm actually going to start with the concerns that many human rights organisations have around the Italians' approach, because it's been highlighted that, you know, once asylum seekers are sent to processing centres in the likes of Albania, they're automatically detained. And many occasions, many of them are subject to extreme violence, which is a huge problem. And also around the fact that there is a real focus on obviously stopping people reaching Italian shores, which is how Giorgia Meloni has reduced the numbers. But there seems to be no focus on reducing the number of deaths in the water.
Right.
There have been a number of reports on how many migrants have died. I think it's around 3,100 migrants have died in the Mediterranean last year, according to the International Organization for Migration. At the press conference, Giorgia Meloni really brushed aside the issue of, you know, migrants being left stranded in northern African countries like Tunisia. And, you know, we put it to Keir Starmer, is he not concerned about this? And obviously Downing Street said, you know, they are seriously concerned, but they stress that any strategies that they decide to adopt from Italy will obviously comply with international law.
Yeah, because there's a worrying aspect to this among several to do with potentially what would happen if you copied over this approach. So Meloni's government restricts, as far as I understand it, the ability of charitable organisations, for example, to rescue people in the Mediterranean and then bring them into Italy. Now, the British equivalent of that is apparently would be clamping down on the RNLI, the lifeboats, right? We both know that Matteo Salvini, Meloni's deputy, is currently facing calls from prosecutors over a decision in August 2019 to stop a migrant boat from docking, and he could be imprisoned for 6 years, right? So it's not like these things aren't replete with problematic elements. Let's talk just for a minute about these sort of signals we're getting that the Labour Party quite fancies copying some of this in terms of migration policy. Chiefly, I think, as far as the processing of asylum claims in a third country, Albania in this case, is concerned. The Labour Party is obviously trying to find a more palatable migration plan that won't upset as many people as the Rwanda plan did. But I guess on the evidence so far, it won't be that dissimilar. There is a caveat here, which I think in the Italian system, if while in Albania you are deemed a genuine refugee, you then get to live in Italy. And in that sense, it's different from the Rwanda plan, where irrespective of the decision, you'd have to live in Rwanda. I mean, the political calculation here is pretty obvious. The Labour Party is worrying about voters in areas where reform came second to the Labour at the last election. So it thinks it's got to go in this direction. I suppose they'd make an argument about making sure the asylum system works or some such. Alita, do you think something of this nature is going to become policy? Feels like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's very likely. Keir Starmer repeated at the press conference that his approach to tackling illegal migration is going to be dictated by British pragmatism. When he was asked repeatedly if this is a policy that, you know, could actually become a very real thing in the UK, he said simply that he's open to listening to all different types of strategies and to remain interested in learning from countries like the Italians. So, I mean, it's very possible that this could be on the cards. I mean, when I did speak to some Labour MPs within the soft left sort of caucus of the party, some of them seem to be convinced that it's one thing that the Labour government might have to adopt. And then we can look at comments from big charities like that of the Labour heavyweight David Miliband, who's charity was saying the government should simply not adopt this strategy, and also echoed the fact that they should create more safe and legal routes. Downing Street has said that is not on the cards in the near future, which is a real problem. But, I mean, the fact remains that many Labour MPs are just simply uncomfortable with the politics of how it looks.
So that's the next question, right? It seems as if they are moving, albeit somewhat tentatively, in this direction. You talk to Labour MPs a lot. How, A, did they feel about Starmer's meeting with Meloni? And then, B, how do they feel about this sort of superficial tilt in Labour policy, the fact that the government seems to be moving in this direction? How is it going down?
I mean, since the run-up to the election, during the election campaign, many Labour MPs are uncomfortable with Keir Starmer's inability to simply call out reform, and they were making some crass remarks, especially Nigel Farage, around the riots. This was also an issue until a few weeks down the line. Keir Starmer was using some really strong language, but it seems that this is happening again around this. Many Labour MPs feel as though the politics of it is just wrong, even if Meloni is currently looking as somebody who is a bit more moderate. Of course, she has her hard right roots. Some of them accept that and are saying, well, okay, you know, she seems to be toning down her language slightly and is looking more serious on the world stage. So, okay, given that Italy's in the G7 and they're one of our NATO allies, maybe this is something that we all might have to swallow as a means of showing to the country that we are trying to tackle illegal migration. Because, you know, quite frankly, a lot of the constituencies that Labour won from the Tories were in areas that feel very strongly about this issue. They're scared of being disciplined. We've seen some Labour MPs being suspended, whether it's for 6 months, it could turn into an indefinite suspension, we don't know. But they are just scared of talking out of turn because of how strict the discipline is at the moment. But many are, quite frankly, appalled and disgusted that Keir Starmer is there enjoying time, joking, smiling with somebody who has extreme hard right roots, somebody like Giorgia Meloni. And they just simply won't accept that, especially around the fact that, again, we spoke about this briefly, the fact that a number of asylum seekers are dying, being left stranded at the hands of her policies and schemes, and Keir Starmer is contributing millions to some of those projects. It's a real problem for them. And they feel as though there's a lack of humanity that is being considered in Downing Street at the moment.
I dare say we might pick up some of this discomfort when we're both in Liverpool. I will see you there, I would imagine. Yeah. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, John.
Thank you. Okay, let's pause here for a minute. When we come back, we'll be looking more broadly at the far right in Europe and what all that could tell us about our own future. Welcome back. I'm now joined by The Guardian's Europe correspondent, John Henley. Hi, John.
Hi there.
Where are you? Just so we know.
Based in Paris, and that's where I am at the moment.
I wish I was. Right, John, we're going to talk about Giorgia Meloni and the new-ish European far right in a moment. But first of all, from your own perspective, you have been covering this kind of politics for quite a long time, it's fair to say.
Yeah, I mean, I've been a foreign correspondent based in the Netherlands, in Paris, in Brussels, and I've written widely from, I think I worked out the other day, every EU member state. For the last kind of 20 years or so, I've seen the curve of the kind of anti-immigration far right has been rising for the last 10, 15 years.
Okay, 10 or 15 years. Now, obviously, one can take the long view and go back into the 90s, 80s, 70s. As you and I both know, in living memory, there's a story to be told about the 20th century. But in terms of the sort of modern political era, when would you say this kind of politics really started to gain ground? And why?
I mean, I think the late 1990s, the early 2000s.
Right.
I mean, I think a watershed moment was Jean-Marie Le Pen, who's the father of Marine Le Pen, the leader of France's national rally, when he made it through to the second round of the presidential election in France in 2002. And I think that was kind of a real wake-up call. Over the last decade, 15 years, I guess since the financial economic Eurozone crisis from 2008 onwards, and particularly the migration crisis, Europe's migration crisis of 2015, which is when there were 1.3 million migrants, refugees, mainly people fleeing the war in Syria, arrived in Germany. There are other issues involved that we're starting to see in the UK as well now, which I think you can't, ignore the impact basically of, these big kind of traditional centre-right, centre-left parties, which used to represent 30 or 40% of the electorate, each of them. And what's been happening over the last 10, 15 years is basically that those parties have been getting smaller and the smaller parties have been getting bigger. And the smaller parties that are growing fastest are populist far-right parties.
Okay, now you just used the word populist. There's a question here about sort of terminology and who is who, right? It's worth noting, first of all, which I think you've hinted at really, that this sort of politics is ubiquitous across mainland Europe. It's happening pretty much everywhere, right? So one sees it in Mediterranean countries. You're also seeing it in Scandinavia, in the old Eastern Bloc. There's loads of it. In fact, some of the most prominent forces in it are in former communist countries, Viktor Orban in Hungary, the stories to be told about Poland. I think the Baltic Republics have their version of it. Holland was quite ahead of the curve with Geert Wilders and so on. France, you've already mentioned. Do we call them populists? Some of these people are most of the way to being fascist, aren't they? Let's be honest.
Well, it's quite kind of a minefield, this terminological debate. What I use, at least, are the kind of definitions that have been adopted by continental European political scientists. And we particularly lean on definitions from a bunch, more than 100, in more than 30 countries. And they define these parties as basically as follows. Many, many far-right parties are populist, but not all populist parties are far-right. There are also far-left populist parties. But populism is this belief that politics should be kind of an expression of the will of the people, and that anything that stands between the will of the people, in inverted commas, and policymaking is wrong. Most importantly, populism is this idea that society is basically separated into two kind of antagonistic groups, like the way they put it is the pure people versus the corrupt elite.
Okay.
The definitions that we use for far-right parties are basically if a party has two key ideologies, it's classified as far-right. Those two ideologies, firstly, is what they call nativism. Nativism is basically the belief that a nation state should be pretty much exclusively lived in by members of the native group, and that anybody non-native to that group represent some kind of threat or menace. And the second ideology is authoritarianism. So they're basically very heavy on law and order.
Okay. And Giorgia Meloni and the Brothers of Italy, her party, I would imagine, in your estimation, lots of other people's, tick both those boxes, right?
Absolutely.
They're authoritarian and nativist.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, here's a question then. Let's talk about centrist politicians in Europe, however many of them remain. How do you think they would view Keir Starmer not only visiting Giorgia Meloni in Rome, but making very admiring noises about her approach to so-called irregular migration?
I think publicly there may be some unease. I think privately on the centre-left there'll be a lot of understanding and comprehension. Because the fact is that over the last decade or so, centre-left parties across Europe, and the UK is no exception, I think, in this, have found this whole migration issue such a political hot potato and so difficult to deal with. They have either kind of basically ignored it, or they have moved increasingly towards the far-right rhetoric and the far-right position on immigration. But I think this is a really critical point, actually. I think that the far-right is now part of Europe's political landscape. There's absolutely no doubt about that. They're in power, in government, in Hungary, in Italy, in Finland, in the Netherlands. They're soon going to be in power in Austria, in elections there. They're propping up a right-wing coalition government in Sweden. They're kind of winning big, really important regional elections in Germany. They just finished as the largest single party in the French parliament in elections, you know. And generally speaking, with every successive election in Europe, including in the UK now, the far right are advancing. And they are advancing on the back of a platform that is very strongly anti-immigration. That's okay. Really one of their kind of key platform points. The result of that, I think, is that everybody else is running scared. I think it is very difficult to win an election anywhere in Europe today if you're not kind of superficially, at least, tough on immigration.
Okay, so the take on Starmer's visit would be, well, that was a bit rum, doesn't it? But I understand why he's done it. There will be a latent sort of sympathy with his position. Right. How are we seeing the EU sort of institutionally deal with it? They passed a bill in April that attracted a lot of comment, right? The new pact on migration and asylum. So is that an example of the EU collectively then feeling the pull of the far right and moving in that direction? It feels like it.
Yeah, it's Europe's response to the 2015 migration crisis. So it's taken, you know, the best part of a decade to put together. It was eventually agreed by all 27 member states. And it contains kind of two main key provisions, I guess. The first is to construct a bunch of kind of detention centres on Europe's borders where people can be held while their asylum applications are being processed. As part of that, also, there is supposed to be an accelerated process for getting rid of people, deporting people whose asylum applications have failed. And the other side of it is what they call the kind of solidarity mechanism, which is a big thing in EU circles. And that basically means that every member state has agreed either to take in a considerable number of asylum seekers, to share the burden with the so-called frontline states, which are Greece and Italy and Spain, broadly speaking. Or if you're not prepared to do that, then you pay a bunch of money. Basically, you give Athens and Rome and Madrid money to help them cope with the influx of migrants. But the problem is, as always, the EU is a group of 27 member states, all of which have different priorities, all of which have different problems. So already, you've got like Hungary and Poland who said, no, we're not going to accept any more relocations under this deal. We've got the Netherlands, which just this week asked the European Commission for an opt-out. Finland, just this week as well, has proposed to kind of really fierce criticism from NGOs and health services and so on, withholding basic health care from undocumented migrants who arrive in Finland. You know, Sweden is proposing giving €30,000 to every individual who wants to go back. Really key to the whole system. Germany, which obviously is Europe's biggest economy, it's also really central geographically, and it just this week reinforced introduced border controls on all the nine borders that it shares with different EU member states, saying that it was suffering, or facing a risk of terrorism and organized crime and excessive immigration. So it's really come back to the top of the EU agenda.
Yeah, and also, this is quite a sizable shift, in the context of somewhere like Germany. Remind me, how far are we from the moment politically when Angela Merkel sort of said, we're here for you, refugees are welcome?
When was she that? Said, we can do it. Yeah, wir schaffen das. Yeah, we can do it. That was 2015.
Right, so there you go, 10 years later, look where we are.
Yeah, exactly. And the kind of irony of it is that, we can do it in terms of integrating. I mean, Germany accepted pretty much, around about a million migrants in 2015, 2016, and pretty much successfully integrated almost all of them. It was an extraordinary achievement. The problem has been the political backlash. And the problem is that these far-right parties who are advancing, by playing on people's fears, by playing on people's concerns, and by promising kind of simplistic solutions to their very real and legitimate worries about the future, about their jobs, about their homes, about their education systems, their healthcare systems, etc. And the failure of the traditional centre-right and centre-left parties to make any real inroads in addressing those people's concerns. That opens the door to the populists. It opens the door to the kind of party that's going to say it's all the fault of the immigrants. I think it's going to take some time to change that. It's going to take centre-right, centre-left, mainstream parties to come up with real concrete solutions to people's real concrete problems.
So, pause there. Your reading of this is not unlike Gordon Brown. Actually, had an article in The Guardian earlier in the week making this argument that you need, therefore, to restore the reputation of centrist politics for delivering housing, job security, decent social care, all of those things that make people feel very precarious. But there's another question that arises from this, right? Is that I'm not sure the solution to this is quite as straightforward. Perhaps centrist parties actually have to start contesting the far right arguments about immigration and multiculturalism and all the rest of it.
I think that is absolutely the flip side of the same coin, and I was going to make precisely that point. Yeah,
that brings me to a question: Do you see any signs anywhere in Europe of that even starting to happen? Of the far right's strongest point, as the far right sees it, being contested?
It's beginning.
Right, where is it beginning?
It's understandably extremely delicate territory for all the reasons that we've discussed, for any kind of mainstream politician. And they're very reluctant to do it. The only senior politician I've seen actually concretely and positively make the case recently was the Spanish immigration minister, who said in very black and white terms, Spain needs at least 200,000 migrants to maintain its economy at the current level and for Spaniards to keep retain their current standard of living. Behind the scenes, interestingly, more is happening. Berlin government just last week struck a deal with Kenya, and there was no actual numbers were released or ever confirmed. But Berlin has agreed with the government in Kenya to take in a certain number of sort of medium qualified workers. Because the fact is that, this is where the whole debate eventually is going to have to change, and quite how people get to that point, I just don't know how it's going to happen. But the demographics are what will change this. Pretty much every single European country is going to see a decline in their population over the coming decades. I reported last year in Latvia, which is one of the worst for kind of depopulation. And according to all the estimates, Latvia and there are other countries in the same boat. Bulgaria is one of them. Typically, these kind of Central and Eastern European countries, there are several of them that are going to face population declines of up to 25% over the next three or four decades. That's just a huge number. And so the simple fact of the matter is that, Europe needs immigrants. And Europe will need more and more immigrants over the coming decades. And so it is going to have to be a question of politicians making that argument and of voters becoming convinced of the validity of that argument.
Yeah, yeah. And this applies to Keir Starmer every bit as much as far-right leaders in Europe. This is the leader of the Labour Party, let's not forget, who has said he thinks immigration should come down despite all the long-term forces, as you've just said, pointing in completely the opposite direction. Thank you for joining us, John.
Pleasure.
And thank you for listening. Next week, we're going to Liverpool, so we can see Keir Starmer at close quarters with all the thrills and pleasures that brings for the Labour Party conference. Pippa Crewe and Kieran Stacey will also be there with Politics Weekly Westminster on Monday. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, make sure you subscribe to Politics Weekly UK, wherever you get your podcasts, and even better, leave us a review, preferably a nice one. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Kikuchi, and the executive producers are Maz Ebtahaj and Nicole Jackson.
This is The Guardian.